Hello, what you know, listeners. Before we get to our last episode for 2019 and season one of this podcast, I want to end as we started with Pierre's gratitude segment by saying thank you for listening to this first season of What You Know About RJ. At the core of this work is relationships, and I feel incredibly honored that you chose to listen in to hear us speak about how our relationships have impacted us and how we impact and contribute to this work called restorative justice. If you found this first season helpful or insightful, please send us a quick email with a note of what you learned to info@caceg.org. We touched on a variety of topics this first season, and we hope to bring you more topics next season. Be on the lookout in 2020 for season two, where we'll reveal our new department name, introduce new team members, and uncover specific topics such as shame, discipline, and whiteness, and take a deep dive with our school partners. If you'd like to donate to support us, you can find our donation page also on our website, caceg.org/donate. Please mention this podcast in the comments section. If you're interested in trainings, please check out our website in January for our schedule of open trainings. As always, please be sure to rate, review, and please subscribe to know when our new episodes are available. Once again, please send us a quick email of what you learned to info@caceg.org. Thank you for listening. Continue being kind to yourselves and your relations. Peace out. Welcome to What You Know About RJ, Restorative Justice, Sharing Stories and Skills, a podcast of the California Conference for Equality and Justice. I am your host for this final episode for this season, and one that I have been super excited about and trying to schedule for a very, very long time. Before I get to the special guest, my name is Gilbert, with RJ in Schools, soon to be renamed. And then today's RJ in Schools Squad Spotlight is on the amazing, the powerful, and for me, the very grounding Tanya Suzuki. What's up, Tanya? How you doing?
Hey, Gilbert. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I wanted to begin first by asking what have been your roles in education and in RJ? What's coming up for you right now that you want to share?
My roles in education. I think even before I completed high school, I was already dabbling in just working at a school. So everything from after school programs, helping little ones, after school tutoring, and then eventually I started getting into college readiness when I was in college, working in high schools, working for the state, doing accessibility programs, and all the while trying to figure out if I was going to go into teacher education, mm-hmm. which I eventually did. Working for the internships were part of my teacher education program required that I spend time on school campuses. So really seeing all the different roles that are on a school campus and the ways that students are engaged in these programs or processes. And then of course, eventually, I wanted to go into school counseling after being in a teacher education program and just a few folks that were mentors or teachers, professors, kind of guided me into this direction of going into counseling. And then with that came opportunities to also get a degree in marriage and family therapy to develop a strong psychology foundation for going to school counseling. But I think it's in school counseling where I kind of honed in on this thing around relationships and how that was something that was not acknowledged on a school campus, or at least the school, the LAUSD school I was working at the time. And then once I got pushed out of LAUSD, RJ came into my life very inadvertently. I was just trying to take any job. And just through some educators, a network that it was just my friends, actually. It wasn't even a professional network of any kind, who offered up an after-school type of position at a nonprofit. And long story short, when they found out about my background, they kind of funneled me into this sister nonprofit organization called Sentinel Youth Services, where I learned about peer mediation. And that through that program was how I learned about restorative justice and became informed about the field and also the different ways that RJ was being implemented. And so, and that eventually led me to CCEJ, where I learned about CIRCLE and being just really getting back to that question around relationships. And so that's kind of my trajectory. Mm-hmm. Sorry for that long-winded historical thing, but that's been my process.
I mean, that's long because the work is rich and big. So these first questions are questions that I've been asking everybody on the team in all the episodes. And so the next one is, what has brought you joy in your work?
When you talk about in my work, collectively or just my work at, I guess, CCEJ or RJ, doing RJ?
I think what I'm going to say is whatever work is, whatever you're defining as work right now for you.
What really brings me joy in my work is the opportunities to go back and forth between thinking through what relationships look like or the dynamics that comprise relationships with young people, so mm-hmm. intergenerationally, and then also how we're able to share this knowledge and or share these stories with my adult peers, mm. especially those that are working with young people. So I think in these moments that I have working with youth, it's very experiential, right? Seeing and witnessing their struggle to recognize what their needs are, or even their emotions, and being able to witness the struggle, but also the awakening or the emergence of whether it's their own dignity or the emergence of this understanding of connection and being connected, connectedness. And then being able to almost, me having this experiential process with young people, being able to take these stories and share them with other adults who are working with young people, and having these dialogues and also there witnessing the emergence that comes out of these exchanges with them. It's beautiful and brings me joy to see how much possibility is in this work when we're able to share our stories, share our joys, and also almost coach each other and hold each other accountable to our own wellness.
I think about all the struggles and like hold people accountable to their wellness. And so I think about, I guess I'm curious of like, what are some ways that you've held people, teachers and students, yourself, family, community, accountable to wellness?
It's almost selfish sometimes when I think about collective accountability for wellness, because my wellness is so intricately linked to yours, mm-hmm. you know, and I think the experience of, you know, these coaching programs or these coaching programs I've been a part of, or somatics, learning about somatics, everything all together really highlights and amplifies the what I mentioned earlier about the intricate relationships we have with one another, and how it actually behooves me to make sure that you're mm-hmm. okay, because when you don't show up 100 or you're as your best or trying to be your best, it affects me, it impacts me, and then it becomes like the chicken or the egg conundrum of, you know, why are things all so just feeling not so good right now? Why is everything off? Why is what we talk a lot about in RJ's culture, right? Like, it's a nuance that is hard to measure, quantify, but it's definitely palpable and felt. So I think going back to your question about how do I hold this thing called accountability for wellness with folks, well, I name that, you know. I name the fact that I'm open to dialoguing about, like, is it selfish of me that I need you to be well in order for you to show up here as your best, you know, and trusting and leaning into that possibility that can emerge out of the dialogue and me naming that. Mm.
It makes me think about this other question connected, like, what does it mean to be well? Because I think there's different images and different definitions of that. One time you made a presentation to us around love. And so I wanted to ask you something like what that means in terms of love and education.
I do remember this. Mm-hmm. And this is when I first came to CCEJ and arrived to the Restorative Justice in Schools team. And I was just really wide-eyed and bushy-tailed about just being on such a dope team. Just people that I'm just like, I just met but already admire, and just wondering what can it bring, you know? And so I had just come off of this comeback from a conference called Free Minds for People in Oakland. And I need to shout out my comrade, Shireen Hannigan Martinez, who did a workshop presentation on punk love versus compa love. And compa deriving from the word, I believe, compañero or compañera.
Well, it could be. I know it as, or I think of it as compadre and comadre too, but yeah. Which is a word growing up that I heard my dad and my tios say to each other, and it was a or to my dad would say it to his brother-in-laws or to like his long his homies, like his longtime friends, and I would never hear it anywhere else. I would hear my mother say it to friends she had like forever. And so it's for me, it's this, yeah, it's different than hermano, it's different than carnal. Like for me, in terms of the three sectionalities of Chicano masculinity, compadre is like elevated and of age and wisdom, of which I don't feel ready yet to call. I have some friends that are definitely on a level, but I don't feel like we, as of our age we are in right now, can use that phrase. But what trips me out is that on the show on my block on Netflix, like these like high school kids in like South LA, East LA, they say that to each other, and I'm like, no, you're not using it. No, you're not ready to use it yet. But so yes, but so that's how I think of it as well.
Yeah. Thank you for elaborating and sharing your lived knowledge and lived experience of using that word, because I think that in itself kind of defines the stance or the philosophy that Shireen was trying to communicate. Or really break down for folks is the relationship, right? Mm-hmm. And speaking on compa, love, this love, and by the way, before I say anything else, what came up for me as you were talking about how you define compa,
mm-hmm.
Also was this. You said this like this higher way of naming your relationships, but also it's you're choosing, right? It's like a choice, and who you would exalt to this position of being your compa to be there for you when you falter or provide wisdom.
And specifically, too, I just wanted to add that the compadre, comadre was growing up was also super specific to the godparents of your child. And so the people who in a party or at the house would always be called comp or compadre, comadre were our padrinos, like our godparents. So that was always a specific term just for them. And so, which I just wanted to name that because I'm also, you know, I think you use the word trust, no? So just thinking about the careful selection of the selection around godparents.
Absolutely. And families. Absolutely. I recently, over the summer, earlier in the summer, witnessed they're about to be parents, kind of go through the process of choosing their godparents. And it's just an interesting process to see them. It's a very intentional and, you know, like what we're talking about, it's very laden with trust and just that faith that these chosen folk are going to not just do right by their God child or whoever they've been chosen to look after, but also just provide guidance and again, not so much like that they have their best interest in mind, but really deeply understanding need.
Did you ever apply compa love as RG coordinator?
Actually shared this concept with the folks I work with at the school. where I was, or I was doing RJ work at, and it was a great experience to witness the myriad of different kinds of teachers with the different teaching styles and stances, dialogue about their own thoughts of the two, these two different kinds of love, right? And so the other love is punk love, or a loveless relationship under the guise of love, right? Because in a lot of, in the work in education, a lot of educators, we throw around the word love for our students quite often. And it's, you know, we love the children, it's all for the kids, and my kids, or we call them our babies, and I'm not so much critical of that, but more so what's underneath that, you know, how do we show up with young people under this guise of love, or at least this social construction of how needing to love our students and our youth, mm-hmm. in order to do this work. You know, and so I think it's been, I do use this concept in my work, but not so much in this heady place where we're trying to define what it is, but trying to figure out how we can do that from a centered place that is below the neck in our bodies. Mm. You know, how we can feel how we can actually embody love or trust or connectedness with our young people while upholding not just their dignity but ours. And so how do we do that all at the same time in a centered place in our bodies?
What does punk love and compa love say about a student who we perceive as embodying disrespect or defiancy?
Well, punk love would is like tough love.
Uh-huh, okay.
Right? So for your own good, I'm going to do these things. And usually when we're talking about adult or teacher-student dynamics or adult-youth dynamics in a school, what that looks like is shame and punishment. Mm. And the reasoning underneath it doesn't go to any further than, you know, I know what you need. And this prescriptive stance we have as adults when it comes to what's best for young people. I think that's a default thing that happens when students begin to embody what you said, like disrespect, right? And I think even saying that, like when students, I don't know how students embody disrespect.
Well, the perception,
right.
that some
right.
people have a disrespect, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what's embodied, I think, or this whole process of being able to identify and recognize what's being embodied is part of this relationship building that, or part of that process of building a relationship when we start to recognize the needs, because we understand their stories. Mm-hmm. We understand their contexts.
Is compa love trying to identify needs then? And work from needs?
Yeah. But I think it'd be like, when we talk about needs, especially in RJ, I think we have a tendency, because we're practitioners, to come from this heady place mm-hmm. of figuring out needs. And I think it's a great jump from, you know, even anything that's come before that, like as far as our development of understanding this work. So I don't want to dismiss, talking about needs mm-hmm. at all. But I think in a compa relationship, in this trusted relationship, this idea of tú eres mi otro yo or Ubuntu, like, is I understand, and I am connected with your struggle and your place of harm, and instead of being sympathetic, you embody being empathetic, which is just experiencing the struggle as my own, and what would I need in this moment,
And it makes me think about the first question around accountability to wellness, and what you were saying about your wellness is tied up into my wellness, and the question of this, like, self-reflection question for me in the moment with somebody else, a colleague or a student, of what is it that I need right now? Or what is it that I think maybe even another question of, like, how am I loving myself right now? Or how am I being well right now? So this is a question that Jenny came up with a few weeks ago when we were thinking about what questions to ask you, what seed for you to water. And a question that Jenny had was, how do you consistently show up with young people when young people are not always so consistent?
Before I answer that mm-hmm. question, I think something that I say a lot, something I witness a lot in RJ work is, folks who seek out RJ support, they obviously, they want to have more conflict resolution, and they're seeking support for when harm and conflict happens, right? And we often talk about how before we get to harm and conflict work, we ask what kind of building or community building has been going on, right? They tend to talk about how problematic the students are, or they're getting into these arguments or being disrespectful, and so what I always say is, what I end up having to note with folks is that the students always are consistent, even with all the things that they do, all the things that come up for them, all the myriad of ways in which they respond to situations, like in all that chaos and the ways that they show up, like no matter where I go, in the communities that I work with, as when we're talking about communities of color, to me the students are always consistent with what they bring. Mm. And what's not consistent is the way that we engage and handle the students. But that's kind of like the big overall picture, like zoomed out, mm-hmm. right? When we zoom in, yeah, of course we're gonna see all the different ways in which they've, in their short years on this earth, have already seen things that I would never even fathom, So when we're talking about consistency, I see in this zoomed out kind of way where young people, and then they're always consistent with trying to grow, and even mm-hmm. when they mess up and make mistakes. As far as how do I stay consistent, what they teach me is about possibility. And in doing RJ work, I feel like that's at the one of the pillars of why we repair, or this process of repair when conflict happens. not just believe and hope that there's a possibility for repair, but this commitment and knowing that because there's a relationship, repair is possible. And being able to, what we like to say, leverage, you know, the relationship in order to figure out ways to get our needs met. And that's the heady piece, or the thinking piece. And when I think about possibility from an embodied place, I think about the ways that young people are consistently able to shift their hearts. Mm. In the midst of confusion and hurt and anger, witnessing those, that emergent moment when we're able to hear the story and hear the lived experience of another person that we acknowledge we have a relationship with. Being able to witness that shift, that emergence, I think just makes me even more committed each time, a little bit deeper in how I show up with young people. And again, I always go back to this thing about, is it selfish of me? Because I get so much out of it, you know? I get so much joy. I get so much hope and medicine for the things that I'm going through. To be able to witness these shifts, these emergent moments, to be able to transfer and translate back into my own life and then share that with the people I care about. Mm-hmm. And the people I care about are the relationships I have relationships with amazing geniuses all around me that are in civilian clothes, you know. And when I'm able to share some of these experiences, it's not like me imparting anything to them, because I just love to dialogue, you know. And I'll tell folks about what I've experienced, and then these amazing folks will give me feedback, or just me bouncing ideas off of them. We co-create like even more epiphanies and reflective moments about how we can heal and what that looks like, and continue to do it in the different respective roles we have in our lives, whether it's working with young people or not.
What have young people gotten from working with you?
I have never really thought about that. Again, I think it's like almost like a selfish stance that I have, because I'm like, well, after these moments I have with them, like, they pour love into me, mm-hmm. you know? They pour it into me, and so I feel like they're just vibrating at a higher frequency, for the lack of a better way to describe it. The hope I feel in their bodies, like what's emanating from them, it helps me to know that they're going to be okay. And of course, in my work, there's a slew of other young people that are waiting for support, you know, and being able to be around young people helps me to really hone in on my, this, what do you want to call it, the skill, or being there for them in their time of need, but also in their time of joy. Like when they're experiencing joy, I see that they're able to fully take in joy instead of having these lens not being enough in the eyes of another, you know. And being able to have these experiences with them, in which I witnessed it I witnessed these shifts or these epiphanies they have about themselves or really their relationships, I'm able to be there to remind them, hey, remember when this happened? And or I love being their reminders and seeing their face or their feeling their energy shift when they remember that what they're made of and what they're able or they're capable of doing. And I hope what they take away is not just resiliency, because I've been thinking a lot about moving past survival, like surviving to thriving. Because resilience to me is so important and so definitive of why people of color are still standing here today. You know, resilience is so important. I would never want to ever minimize that or throw that away or dismiss it. But I also, in the spirit of yes and, how do we also now bring in joy? You know, how do we thrive now while we still gotta be resilient and be resistant to, let's just call it oppression. Yeah, like I want to remind folks as well as myself that we're also here to thrive.
Mm. What do you do to work on your own resiliency?
I practice feeling to heal, feel to heal. I see that a lot now. I don't know if I actually literally have seen it somewhere, but I feel it. Allowing myself to move through the emotions. And one of my close friends just shared that with me last weekend. You know, she knew about me going through some sadness right now, and it's real sadness, you know, melancholy sadness. And as we all do, we want to, you know, just get over it, right? We want to get over it. We want to move past it. We want to heal. We want to be done with it and get on with it. But she kind of slowed me down and said, you know, Tanya, the best way to get past it is through it. Not to fly above it or be distracted by anything or distract ourselves, but to really just go through it. And it was such a profound moment because I got emotional. And again, I think that was at the same time when I was realizing that I just needed to feel some of the sadness. And it's been very powerful for me to allow myself to feel the sadness, to acknowledge it, to name it, and then let myself feel it. And really in my body versus having all that energy in my head. And so sitting with it, making myself feel these emotions, it's amazing because when I actually do it, if I was to quantify the time, each moment it's like maybe 15 to 20 minutes, you know, that I'm like either full of rage and I'm just going off and recognizing where my energy is. And if it's in my head, I move it. I suspend that part of me to activate it any further and really move it into my body. And it takes about like a good maybe 15-20 minutes or less for that energy, emotion, which is what energy, emotion, right, move through my body. And I don't know if that's healing per se, but that's a question I always ask folks now. I know when we say we heal, what does that look like? I'll tell you what it looked like for me yesterday. But I want to hear more about what other folks experience, because it's somewhere in the middle of all of that, you know.
Mm.
And for me, this practice of resiliency has been to not just name my emotion, but allow myself to move through it. And realizing when I come out the other end, not healed per se, but had been engaged in this process of healing, afterwards realizing that I could do this. I might go through it again the next day or night. And I'm not gonna say it gets better or easier, but this fear of feeling definitely gets less or is lessened. I'm not gonna say the hurt is less, but the fear of feeling is almost not there for me anymore. It's like, okay, just feel it.
Mm.
Yeah. We do so much to not feel.
Mm-hmm.
We're good at it. We're experts at it. We could do, we're so good at, if we don't want to feel something, we won't do it. Well, our consciousness or our subconsciousness or our unconsciousness will actually do it all for us so that we don't have to feel.
That makes me think about how feelings, expressing feelings, having feelings, living in feelings can disrupt the movement of institutions. Like I think about, like, you know, again, in the context of a school,
mm-hmm.
I think about how, like, some of the things that we do in this work disrupt the flow of the work of a school. And I think about, you know, like when we ask people if the way you felt was like the weather, what would your weather be? And all of a sudden, I've been thinking a lot about adults as I've been hearing you. Because it's been, I spent a long time working with young people. And it was a weird shift to work, to shift over to adults. And I almost felt like a betrayal. Mm-hmm. For me in the beginning, but then I was getting a lot of, I do get a lot of joy in working with adults and challenging them, creating containers of space for them to be in their feelings. You talked about young people operate at a higher vibration frequency. And for me and for many adults, there's times when that vibration frequency is really dull. Like, I don't think it ever goes away, but it can slow down. And so I think about the ways in which the things that we do, the things that I do, help to bring some frequency back in. You can see someone's face as they're telling a story, or, you know, we're playing a game, or you feel the mood shift, the energy shift. Or someone tells a story, and the room becomes sad, and we just hold it and be in that space collectively together. I think feelings don't go away. They're always there because we're human. But what the work of being in a school calls for is a lot of movement and moving through, and not always the opportunity to be in feeling. And so I think about how feelings can disrupt in a positive way, to bring people back into frequency and vibration. I feel like you mentioned this already, but I've been asking everybody on the team these last two questions. And the first one is, what's something that RJ has taught you or is teaching you?
I did mention this, which is around possibility.
Mm.
And the teaching part has been, like I mentioned this earlier too, that it's more than a commitment or a belief. And I think I'm being a little reflective and contemplative right now because in a personal situation right now, I think I'm at a stuck place around possibility. But because of what I do, I know possibility exists in the most seemingly dire of situations. And how possibility comes about is through relationships. We can't exist on our own. Like, that's a knowing I have now. I think it was a belief of mine before, like, of course, you know, relationships and people that we gotta depend on each other and things like that. It was more of a belief or something I was taught or something in my head that I figured, yeah, of course, you know. But today, now, after engaging in this work for as long as I have, and all my collective experiences, especially working in a school and with young people, what I'm walking away with today, and not so much away, but onto my other journeys as I continue my role and purpose of supporting young people and people who work with young people, is that I am able to embody possibility. This has happened, or this is possible, because of all the relationships that I've cultivated and nurtured in my, I would say, the past 10 years, which is, you know, which coincides with when I began this work doing RJ. Being able to embody possibility means that I'm always able to access this knowing at any given time. That's been my biggest teacher.
I'm going to wind us down. I'm going to ask this question that I forgot to ask in conversation. Mm-hmm. But we've been asking everybody to tell a story about your name, your powerful name.
I do this a lot because it's a popular circle question, right? And
do you ever find that the story changes a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah. I do too.
It does. It's a warming topic. But what I'm going to choose to talk about today will be my last name. And also my mother's last name. This is something I've never mentioned ever in circle. So my invisible last name, which is my mother's maiden last name. So my mom's maiden last name is Srichandra. It's Thai. And it's spelled Srichandra. The D-R-A in Thai is silent. So the way you pronounce Srichandra in Thai is Sitan. And Sitan means the color of the sun. I'm sorry. Oh my gosh. I thought this the whole time. It's not the color of the sun, it's the color of the moon. Whoa. Yo, I'm having a crazy moment right now. Okay. Wow, that changes so much. So it's the color of the moon is the meaning of my invisible last name, my Thai last name. And it's always powerful to me, just my Thai identity, because it's also hidden in terms of visibility. I look visibly Japanese, or at least to most folks. And so, being able to speak on my Thai side is always important to me. But now, recognizing that the meaning of that my mother's last name is the color of the moon, oh, it's so much more deeper for me. And my moon side, my these dynamics of the moon have been so amplified for me this past year, 2 years. So interesting. And I just like the fact that Sitan is our way of pronouncing it. And if you're not Thai, you wouldn't pronounce it Sijan because it's clearly, you know, spelled a certain way. So I like that esotericness to my Thai last name. And my Japanese last name is Suzuki, which obviously caused a lot of angst for me growing up. A lot of kids making this Suzuki noises, and if you didn't know, they'll make sounds like Suzuki when I walk past, or you know the interesting questions I get about my last name. But obviously, this is from my father, who is Japanese, and I used to hate my last name for the obvious reasons growing up because I was being ridiculed for it. But today, I'm so proud of it. I mean, at 17, I got it tattooed as a trans dab on the back. In Old English. What other font would I pick? My dad passed last year, on March 18th, 2018. And not so much that I recognize its importance after his death, but ever since his death, it's just been deeper, you know, by my roots and where it comes from. And so, I love that I have my father with me all the time, because when he was alive, it was hard to always, be present with him, and because of our relationship. But my last name means, Suzu means bell, and ki is a tree, and so it's like an ornamented tree or a beautiful tree. And so again, I don't know if it's after my father's death, but I'm always reminded of my father everywhere I go. When I see beautiful trees, I see my eyes focus in on trees and things, and I feel my dad all the time now. And sometimes I don't know if it's just because I'm like on a spiritual tip, or I'm trying to make sense of mad dragonflies that show up everywhere I go, and butterflies, and hummingbirds. But whenever I do see them, whether it's the trees or the hummingbirds or the dragonflies, I say, hi Dad, hi Daddy, and thank you. Thank you for all that you've given me and continue to give me through these messages and signs that you're around.
Wanna land this conversation? Anybody that you want to shout out? Anybody in your organization? Any non-human thing in nature that you've gratitude or to shout out?
I definitely shout out my comrades from the People's Education Movement, and I have comrades here in LA, and we have a chapter in the Bay, and also folks in Chicago. And the summer has been such a testament to the work that I've been doing on myself about role and purpose. And as heady as all that sounds, when I'm in space with my comrades, I feel so grateful for the opportunity to build, nurture, and cultivate these relationships. Again, kind of helping me to make more sense in an embodied way of why relationships make the world go round, you know, why why relationships are things that we don't often uplift as a central piece to why we exist and how we're able to survive and thrive. So definitely comrades. I already mentioned my father, because my father comes up all the time, but I live in my father's space now, so I thank him every day, every moment. And I just thank him for the legacy he left behind and the gifts he passed on to me, and I wanna honor him by making sure that I actualize these gifts that he keeps reminding me about. And finally, just all my relationships. I mean, I'm sitting before one right now. Yeah. It's just too many folks to name, but the people that I've had the honor of working with, like you and Belia, Jenny Taharka, Pierre, and the rest of the CCEJ crew, while we were together, it's priceless. And and it doesn't end there. You know, these relationships keep going. And so I'm so excited and so beyond grateful, deeply, deeply humbled and grateful for these relationships that continue to provide a purpose and role for me to show up for the people I love and care about and be reminders for them about to take care of ourselves, you know. And again, the selfish piece being it gets reciprocated back to me, so we all end up just kind of loving on each other and making sure that we're okay. That's just, it's never going to be enough, you know. I mean, meaning like it just, there's no finiteness to the way that we can take care of each other, that it's just ongoing. And it's not so much this like Pollyanna way of looking at things. It's like I live these experiences in my pain and my trauma and my stuckness, like being able to share space and break bread with you last Friday, like opened up so much more possibility for the ways that I'm gonna like heal from my sadness and all the other shit. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for continuing to believe in me and care about me, Gilbert, and giving me this space and platform to not just name my purpose, but really step into it.
My gratitude and my desire for people to witness me right now is for me to tell you that in the mornings, when I do my morning prayers, I will often give gratitude to the teachers in my life, and you are one of the names that I speak to the universe in gratitude. And so I'm grateful for your teaching, for your healing, for your friendship. So just wanting to send that out to you across the table from me, and to have folks witness that as well.
Thank you. My heart just received all of that. Thank you so much.
With that, we're going to close out. Thank you for being here. This has been What You Know About RJ, Restorative Justice, Sharing Stories and Skills, a podcast from the California Conference for Equality and Justice. Please visit our website, cacej.org, to check out our materials. And as our closing episode for this first season, with all of the colors and the stories and the feelings that we brought you, as a final close, a request, invitation for everybody, anybody, when they do get to lay their ears to this, is to sit in a feeling today, whatever that feeling is, but to sit in a feeling, because as Tanya told us, that is also a practice of resiliency. So Much love to you across the table from me. Much love to Gompa, love to all folks who are listening. And that's it. Please hear us again for the next series season of What You Know About RJ. Any last thing to say?
Let's get free.
Yeah. Bye, y'all. Take care.